From Relay, this is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of streaming media. This is episode 77, recorded September the 6th, 2024. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell, and with me, again, is Joseph Adalian, the West Coast editor for New York Magazine's Vulture and the writer of the Buffering newsletter, which is excellent, and you should subscribe to it. Joe, welcome back.
Well, hello, sir. Good to be back. Thank you for having me.
It's good. We're settling in. So just off the top, I'll explain. Goal now going forward with Downstream, Joe's going to be here on a regular basis, and we're also going to have some guests going in. Joe may be like every other ish, although this is two in a row. We'll also work in some other people. I want to Will Carroll to talk some sports at some point. We'll get some other interesting faces in, but also you'll hear from Joe a lot. So it's good to have you. We're the same age.
I'll try not to wear out my welcome.
We've got that same Gen X brains. We're molded by so much television that this is all we can think about now is television.
We're both 37 years old, people.
Yeah, that's
37.
Right. That's right. It's exactly. We're young, and somehow I have a podcast where I talk about Magnum PI. So, I mean,
we've got that riz,
it's a giveaway.
Man.
Forget, that's right.
We're not millennials. We're Gen Z.
We got the riz. Sure we do. Sure we do.
Yeah, I have no idea what I'm saying.
Nope. All right. Let's talk about, I want to do a Paramount update because since we last spoke, there's been some excitement with Paramount. Edgar Bronfman, Mr. Seagram, was like, no, I'm going to swoop in. I'm going to outbid Larry Ellison and take over Paramount. And just after we recorded 2 weeks ago, what happened was he looked around and he was like, me and my investors are going to buy Paramount. And he looked back and there was nobody back there. He realized,
you know, he should have thrown in like a lifetime supply of Seagram wine coolers. That would have made the difference.
No,
I just need to drop
a reference
and maybe get some Bruce Willis.
Well,
okay. I guess we can't get Bruce Willis now,
but
you know, we could have got, you know, sadly, but yeah, exactly. That would have been that would have sealed the deal. Cause I think I hear Sherry loved the Seagram wine coolers.
Seagram's
back in the day.
Golden wine coolers. Yeah. And she did not like Bartles and James. Very against.
No, Bartles and James, absolute trash.
An unsuccessful CBS sitcom with the Bartles and James. Sitcom. Not true.
Thank you for your support.
so yeah, it's Edgar Bronfman. I mean, I love it. He that seemed very much like a classic rich guy move, which is wait a second. Surely I see the value here that nobody else seems to see. I can't let this guy just walk away with it. Maybe I can, you know, go in the couch cushions and talk to my rich friends and see if we can put together a deal. And it seems like basically that was the idea, is he figured, surely I can put together a better offer. And he made an initial offer and tried to get it together and got them to extend their go shop provision for a week or whatever. And he couldn't. And on one level, I'd say that was almost due diligence. It's like, hey, I'm also a rich guy who could buy a TV network and a studio. Maybe I should see if I could outbid them. And then, you know, I think there's not a lot of shame, maybe a little shame, a mild shaming in saying, oh, I actually can't.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly embarrassing. And you would think at that level, you would get your stuff together before you go public. And given that this drama has been going on for months, if not years, it seems at this point, I was a little surprised. I'll be honest, I was a little disappointed. I you know, not that I have any deep and abiding under knowledge or understanding or love for Mr. Bronfman and his rich kid Nepo Baby act. But,
yep.
But you know, I somehow seem to think he's at least got some media experience in the way that, to me, Ellison and his group don't. I'm just, there's something, you know, and we'll get to this in a second about the real owner of this whole new company,
yeah.
but there's just something sketchy about it all. And there's something a little concerning about where it's going to go that I'm worried about it. I'm veering close to conspiracy theories here as opposed to actual media analysis. But you know, the Ellisons, I don't know. It seems like they're coming in, and I think that they're not going to be this wonderful, benevolent force they're pitching themselves as. And I guess I was sort of hoping for someone with a little more of an old school knowledge of media to come in there. But you know what? They might not have been able to save the day either. The company has just been screwed up in so many ways over the last 5 years that, you know, it's going to be bad no matter what.
Yeah. So you mentioned it. So who's the mystery billionaire in the corner? Let's unmask him. It is, of course, Larry Ellison of Oracle, who is one of the richest people in the world, and he is David Ellison's dad. And look, Just like I didn't like it when they call the three CEOs at CBS the Pep Boys, because it's just mean. I don't want to make this story that daddy loves me so much he bought me a TV network and a movie studio. Because that's not fair to David Ellison. My understanding is that David Ellison, you know, has that people in the business have some respect for him and what he's done with Skydance, and that he has a lot of other people that he's bringing in on this purchase who are respected media executives, and that this is not that this is what he wants to do. He is not just an idle rich kid who wants to play in Hollywood. He views himself as a lifer in this industry, that this is what he wants to do for his life's work. But it sure helps that his dad is one of the richest men in the world. And when they had to file the paperwork with the FCC, because CBS is a broadcast network, and say, well, who actually owns the majority of the holding company National Amusements after this transaction goes through? The answer is 3/4 of it will be owned, or 2/3 of it, somewhere in there, by Larry Ellison. He's the one with the money. He's the one who's funding this entire thing for his son. And then there's the other, you know, Red Bird, which is the other Jerry Cardinal's VC company, is about, you know, 1/3 to 1/4. But it's, you know, it's Larry. Larry is the one with the money, and David is the one with the strategy. But in the end, it is ultimately daddy to the rescue. And as I put in our notes here, and I know you alluded to it, it does mean that, like Elon Musk buying Twitter, this is another tech billionaire who is a fairly right-wing tech billionaire buying into a giant media corporation. And look, if you can buy a media corporation, you're going to be a billionaire, and you're probably going to be more likely. Look, I was a comm major in college. Even if you're not a right-winger, you are a very corporate sympathetic person, because that's how you got to be a rich billionaire who buys media companies. But still, if it underlines the point of consolidation of media in specific hands, and if you look at something like the history of some other right-leaning or harder right media owners, the question becomes, is this just, I'm going to let my kid run this business, or is this a more active, I want to push this business in a certain direction? And if you work at CBS News, how do you feel about Larry Ellison being your owner?
I mean, you took the words out of my mouth. It's exactly my fear about this. And, you know, I will say fairly right wing undersells it. He's very right wing. He's very Trumpy. In the same, yeah, you know, I don't know if he's quite as Trumpy as Elon Musk.
He's been all over the place in his career, but definitely he was one of Steve Jobs' best pals. But like, again, when you're a billionaire, you can, even if you fancy yourself a liberal billionaire, you're still a billionaire who's concerned about how billionaires are treated. And he is, you're right, recently, Larry Ellison, yes, has been more and more outspoken for Trump and for other figures on the right. He definitely Elon has gone that way.
Elon Musk was semi-liberal and took money from Obama. Of course, he never acknowledges that now. Yeah. But the reason we have Tesla is because of Obama and his policies and his investment, our taxpayer money investment in it. And look, it's where he's ended up. And he has gone straight down that path of, and, you know, even Redbird, you know, with Jeff Zucker being part of that as well, they tried to take over some conservative media in the UK. You know, Jeff Zucker was, I knew him as a fairly liberal person, and he probably is to some degree, but, you know, certainly at CNN. And since then, there's a little disgust for Trump, but there's also a lot of love for money, and there's a lot of love for power. And yes, I do. Look, I don't think CBS News is anywhere near as powerful as it was 20 or 30 years ago, or 40 years ago, and certainly not 50 years ago. So getting CBS News or even CNN at this point only matters so much, except it does give you access to power. It gives you the ability to craft narratives, yeah, and do a whole bunch of other things. And yes, it's incredibly concerning. And that's, you know, to me, what I worry is this about, you know, David gets to run sort of the Hollywood of it all, whatever's left of it. And dad and his people, get to sort of shape the rest of the company. And it just, you know, I'm not, Paramount is not some massively influential company in the way that some of the social media companies are now. And that's just the sad reality of it. So, you know, they'll now control Yellowstone Empire. Oh, well, okay. It's not going to get any more or less conservative. CBS is already in some ways, I wouldn't say Fox News Lite, but certainly goes for a middle to moderate right thrust in terms of a lot of their reporting. My mom's a regular CBS Mornings viewer, and she's like, it's turning into Fox News because there's a lot of stuff that they do lately that sort of she doesn't understand why Gayle King isn't speaking up, you know. So there's it continues that I'm not exactly surprised by this news at all. We knew that Ellison was involved, and that meant Dad's money was involved. The extent of it was a little bit new, but it's we'll see how it evolves. Yeah. I think the real question is, does the long rumored for at least 25 years, I've been hearing rumors and rumblings and people have been talking about, wouldn't it make sense for CBS News and CNN to merge?
Yeah.
Warner Brothers needs to get rid of stuff. Zaslav has finally said, there's only so much I can do. You know, hey, we could sell CNN into CBS and you could be part of that. And suddenly we don't have to worry about it. Then suddenly you've got, Larry Ellison in charge of what used to be called the world's most important news network. That is a little scary, and that's not out of the realm of possibility, yeah. Especially with Jeff Zucker in the wings.
If I had to guess, I would guess that Larry Ellison actually doesn't care about putting that deal of control. But as somebody who was a comm major at UCSD, I will say that, you know, media being owned by giant corporations fundamentally means that they have interests that are, they are always going to be in many ways pro-business and more conservative just because they are owned and operated by big corporations and by business people who have gotten to that point with a certain point of view. I'm not sure Larry Ellison, I doubt he's going to be a Rupert Murdoch level figure of saying, no, we really want to reposition what we're doing here. So my guess is that it's going to just be what it's already been. I don't think that, but we have to see. And the fact is, it is a very rich person who has some very strong political opinions who is buying into a very large megaphone. That's the truth.
And it's as much about what networks like CNN don't cover as what they do. You don't have to be a propaganda machine like Fox News to have a very real, profound, and sometimes dangerous impact. Just, you know, you look at the evolution of CNN over the last couple of years, right? It went from being, really standing, they made a centerpiece of their ad campaign, Truth, during the Trump administration, right? Mm-hmm. And really standing out for calling out Trump. And now you see people like Dylan Byers and Puck sort of talking about the sanctimony of CNN with Brian Stelter. And it's like CNN was not sanctimonious or anti-Trump. It simply realized the moment what it was and called out for what it was. It wasn't MSNBC saying, right. Which even MSNBC isn't nearly as liberal as people say it is by any means. But it was simply objective and sort of being truthful. You can then evolve into something that's wishy-washy, that's about false equivalency, and you get things like CNN or News Nation, which again, News Nation doesn't engage in this sort of out-and-out propaganda as one of its local station competitors, Sinclair, does, where it sort of feeds editorials for all the stations to air. But when you platform people who are far right and treat them just the same and don't really ask the right questions, well, then guess what? You sort of normalize that lunacy. And that's honestly not unlike, I'm going to get really, again, conspiratorial here again for the second time this podcast. But it sort of gets down to what happened with Russia, with the evolution of the media there, where it just becomes, as opposed to the aggressive sort of press that we saw for a brief moment there during Glasnost and Gorbachev and all of that, to sort of like, let's be a little bit less so and a little bit less so. And then even now, it's not everything in Russia is not always about saying how great Putin is, but it's often about not saying what the opposition's doing. So I'm not in worry of CNN suddenly going to become the next Fox News, but I am worried about the punches it doesn't take and the stories it doesn't tell and the false equivalency it sets itself up to do. And you see that if you watch the network nightly newscast now, it's tilting right by not being truthful about what's going on.
This is actually a thing that has happened since David Zaslav took over, especially. And of course, when you read those stories at places like Puck, you also see that it's the influence of John Malone, who is on the board, and is the, you know, godfather of cable TV channels in many ways. And, you know, they, John Malone is a Republican who feels like CNN's coverage was unfair to Donald Trump when he was president. And, you know, again, this is, not to get all comm majory on you, but this is what happens, is exactly what you said, which is, the people in charge don't necessarily roll in like has happened with Fox News and said, this is how we're going to do it. You know, we're working with a political party. But what you do is you put people in charge and you say, well, you need to have this guy on too. You need to have this Republican spokesman along with this Democratic spokesman. And you talk together. And if the news people are like, well, no, because this guy's really extreme and this person's a moderate, It's just it can happen incrementally like that. And it's always when you have a change in ownership or management, just as CNN did, we'll see what happens with CBS here and whether the people put in charge feel like there's a way forward there and how does management respond, or whether they feel like, and this is a point I want to make, Fox News, having been a very successful business for a long time here, has a lot of problems, right? They are being outflanked in right-wing media by the internet and by streaming cable channels and by things like Newsmax. They've been under lawsuits for things that they said that went along with some party line things, but were not true. And they're, you know, the Smartmatic verdict, they're going to owe billions and billions of dollars. And so there's a question like, is it a good, like, I'm not sure anybody, even if Fox News didn't exist, which it does, so you'd have to beat them at their own game, I'm not sure anybody looks at that now and says, I want that model, right? Like that actually might be too dangerous. So you end up in the middle with a milk toasty kind of product.
Well, and that's the problem. That's what makes me question the motivations of these owners, because, you know, if John Malone was just thinking about what's good for business, he wouldn't have, and Zaslav too, they wouldn't have changed strategy, because right. CNN was
ratings,
doing better before.
Yeah, and
CNN's ratings
are
down. Yeah. Exactly. Now, everyone's ratings are down now, because the thing is, Joe Biden was bad for cable news ratings. He allowed people like me, and I know many other people, to simply say, I'm good. I don't need to watch this every day, because I didn't, because I knew the country was running itself and there wasn't a daily drama. The president was just centering himself in our daily lives. I don't think Harris would as well either. And so, you know, I hate when people say, well, the media wants it. I don't think it's that simple. I don't think that everyone who does what they do in the media that helps Trump just wants Trump to win. But I think some of their bosses do, and I think they want to stay employed. And, I do think, you know, we can say, oh, well, Ellison is benign or Malone's benign. Yes and no. There is not, they've not gone out and found their version of a Roger Ailes to create a machine that's meant to hyper focus and attract those kinds of viewers. It's even worse. At least Roger Ailes had a business strategy. He had very good reason to do what he was going to do, because he knew it would be very successful and lucrative. He saw that with Rush Limbaugh and local radio and all of that. There's no business, as you note, there is no business impetus to do this. There's just, hey, we want to play around the margins, and we maybe want to make sure the tax rates stay a little bit lower. And that's what I got, and it's scary. And we'll see. The good news is there are lots of good journalists at CBS News and at CNN. They are not going to completely prostitute themselves for an agenda, but they also do want to keep their jobs. And it's sort of, it's like you said, it's a death by a thousand little cuts that you don't realize until the water gets hot enough that the frog of this is being boiled. There's an analogy in there somewhere. I apologize to anyone trying to follow along with me.
I'll say one last thing if we want to turn this around for a moment. I will also say that although many media owners and billionaires have political opinions, I've found in covering these kinds of people that the opinion that most of them have in the highest regard is making money.
Exactly.
And so there's something to be argued that, like, a lot of media owners and executives will not like what's on their air and will feel like, well, no, I you guys are being mean to the candidate that I like, and will keep their hands off because they realize that there's more money to be made where their media company is now than in them tinkering with it. Other people can't help but tinker with it. And that is, we see that with Elon Musk on Twitter.
Yeah, oh, sure.
And I actually think that's many layers down from Larry Ellison. It's not going to be a big deal, but it's a thing to watch. The CNN CBS News thing is a thing to watch because, as we've covered here before, David Zaslav is going to need to sell some stuff. Like the stock going down he's helped reduce the cash flow problems they've got, but they still have a lot of problems at Warner Brothers Discovery. And really, one of the ways out of this is by selling off a bunch of assets. CNN right. would seem like an asset they wouldn't want to sell off, but at the same time, there's not a terrible fit with something like CBS. And the other thing is, if they ultimately want to merge their stuff with something like potentially Peacock, you can't really kind of stick CNN necessarily in with NBC and MSNBC, so you'd need another home for it. There's some movement there. There's some possibilities there.
You could also merge with Paramount Plus. I don't think that's out of the question either, by the way. And by the way, you can also do joint agreements, joint operate. You sort of find a way to sort of do a partnership that's less of a full sale, or allow, you know, Paramount to sort of, and Ellison to sort of invest in this new operation. So who knows? Lots of different ways. But I do think it'll be shocking if there's not some sort of consolidation, but a lot depends upon how this election goes, and what's needed.
That's true, because there is a general perception that if Trump wins, it will be a lot easier for mergers to happen and be approved. And if Kamala Harris wins, then it will be, like with the Biden administration, at least more difficult to make that case of, we're going to take these two movie studios and TV networks and merge them together, that would be less likely to be approved. So there's a lot of waiting and seeing for some of these big calculations, I think. All right, let me take a short break and tell you about this episode of Downstream. It's brought to you by Tract. If you're feeling overwhelmed or not knowing what to watch next, let Tract be your perfect companion for tracking what you watch. Tract helps you discover what's popular and where to stream it. There are links to hundreds of streaming services worldwide. Like a lot of us, you probably stream from a variety of different sources. Tract knows your favorites and automatically notifies you when something is available to stream. But it's not just about discovering new content. It's about staying on top of what you're already watching. The Up Next feature organizes all the shows you follow into a simple checklist so you never miss another episode. So easy to lose track of something that's on a streaming service that you don't visit that often, and then it comes back and like, where am I? Which episode are we in? It can be very difficult. And if you prefer using a media center like Plex or Kodi, Tract offers even more integration options with dedicated plugins for those platforms, so Tract can automatically track what you're watching, making it easy to sync your media across devices. I have been using Tract. It's great, especially because there are some streaming services, as I said, that I just lose track of. Netflix, I'm looking at you. Some other things like PBS. There's some other stuff where I just forget that it's there. And then I turn to my wife and I say, wait a second, weren't we watching a show about this thing? And we can't even remember what it was. Tract has been great at helping me remember what's on the agenda when we sit down to watch TV in the evening. One of the coolest features is Tract Year in Review. It visualizes all your viewing habits from your most watched shows to the day of the week you're most likely to binge. It's always exciting to look back at a year in review and share those insights with fellow film lovers. You can leave comments, rate movies, engage with the community, enhancing the overall experience. Yeah, log your movies, not just your TV shows, using Tract. It's on the web, it's on Android and iOS, and now on Apple TV too. And you can get a 50% discount on Tract VIP edition by going to tract.tv. That's tract.tv/downstream. tract.tv/downstream. Not going to spell downstream. For a 50% discount on VIP. That's right. One of the best services to track what you're watching, get personalized recommendations, and discover new shows and movies. That is tract.tv, tract.tv/downstream for 50% off your first year of Tract VIP. Thank you to Tract for supporting Downstream. All right, let's move on and talk about movies, which is under the purview of Downstream because movies also stream. And I was thinking of a couple of stories that I wanted to mention to you. One is something I saw that happened on Twitter, actually, where Scott Mendelson posted about his theory that Netflix intentionally overpays for potential theatrical breakouts to take them off of the market and take them out of movie theaters. It's not about folks watching Hitman on Netflix. It's about audiences not being able to go to the movie theater to watch it. Now, this is based on a statement by Neon CEO Tom Quinn lamenting that he got outbid for Hitman by Netflix. You know, like, Joe, you like a conspiracy theory.
Hey, this is my now branding, I guess, for this podcast. Ay vey, what have I done? Look, Scott, I'm sure, is a fine person. I don't know him very well. But come on. I mean, you know, do you buy this, first of all?
No. Here is what I think about it. I like it because it makes you think that one of the things that happens when a streaming service buys a movie is that it's not in a movie theater, or it's not in a movie theater for very long. It qualifies for an award, something like that. And I think if you don't consider that as one of the reasons, I think you should. I think that it is a reason, but it seems like a fairly small reason to me. I do like the idea of taking things off the table, but I don't think that the big strategy is if we buy all the tent poles, there will be no tent poles. I don't think that's the case.
No, I don't think, you know, first of all, Netflix can benefit downstream, to use a phrase, from movies that play in theaters and are big hits. It, as long as you make an output deal with it or has the rights, it enjoys having stuff that has been exposed elsewhere. It does not want to be the only source of content in entertainment. It wants to be the dominant source of time and attention in America and wants to get as much of that attention as possible, but I don't think that means eliminating all other forms of entertainment, including movies. Look, the reason that movies cost more to make on Netflix or Apple or anywhere else in streaming is because the owners buy out the back end. They assume it's going to be a hit, and it's why cost budgets skyrocket in television. It's because everything's a success, right? Instead of having to worry about, you know, first dollar percentage against grosses and Hollywood accounting and how much money we're going to make and all that, they say, okay, we're going to pay you this much money right now. And it has to be an extraordinary sum, because if someone is truly thinks they've got an idea that could be a $1 billion idea or a $500 million idea or $250 million box office idea, you know, they can make a lot of money that way. This sort of takes it out of that possibility. And so in order to do that, if you've got something like Knives Out, which has a big sort of upside potential in a second cycle in a sequel, then you've got to pay through the nose, and you're probably going to overpay because you're assuming the best case scenario,
right?
And you have to make it attractive, and you have to realize that your actors and your producers and directors have to give up that egotistical thing of everyone's going every weekend for a couple weekends to see my movie and how great I am, and people online are talking about me, and I get potentially more awards and all of that. You know, I'm a TV guy, and I'm sorry, things that run only on TV can be incredibly impactful, always have been. Movies that run only on television can be just as impactful as those that are in theaters. I am still talking, as you are decades later, about The Day After, an ABC TV movie about nuclear holocaust that aired and never ran in movie theaters, as far as I know, and was incredibly impactful. Lots of movies are, lots of TV shows are. You know, movies are a great experience, and, you know, But so can movies that only air on TV. You know, there people still talk about the movie Scorsese made for streaming just as much as they do about, not as much as perhaps some of his golden classics for movies, but that's just a function of, you know, you're not going to do The Godfather again or Goodfellas or Casinos at his age. And you can still do great stuff. Same thing with Spielberg, as late in his career. And, you know, he had movies that were released in theaters and they didn't win awards. And, you know, it did help. He said, no, it has to be in theaters. Well, they went in theaters and people sort of went to some of them, but not really. People still liked the reviews, and people who love the movies will still love them. It's I don't know what it is, but it's tiresome. You know, Netflix has had lots of success with movies that it made, like The Kissing Booth, which for if you're Gen Z is probably foundational. You know, I've never seen it, but like all those movies that they've done, you know, they continue to live in people's minds. They watch them again and again. They never were in theaters. I have problems with Netflix's movie strategy. I think they should find a way.
Yes.
To find a detente with movie theaters, but that's also on the movie theater chains, to some degree. And also, you know, this is the last thing I'll say, because I realize I'm filibustering here. You know, I think we are going to talk about, are we not going to talk about the movie that was, the Apple movie, right?
Yeah.
We'll talk about that later, but this whole idea of like, people are worried about the box office reporting. It's a thing. It's like, that's, you know, thankfully, I think reporting in the TV business has gotten a lot better in the last 5 years about ratings and people understanding that, you know, if House of the Dragon airs on HBO on Sunday night and does 800,000 viewers, 5 years ago, 7 years ago, there would have been a meltdown. Oh my God, no one's watching this show. But now we understand that 80 to 90% of viewing of HBO shows takes place now on Max, not on HBO Linear. Or that even people who watch it on HBO watch the encores or the DVR it. So there isn't this sort of knee-jerk reaction as often. It still happens with that, with this. With movies, on the other hand, because of the model and everything, it's like, oh my God, it only made this much money. Well, that movie can still go on if it's an Apple movie and 3 weeks later reach a whole bunch of other people. It's additional money. There needs to be a rethinking of it. And you know, I don't know how you train people to think that, but it's, you know, it's
I mean, Netflix, so the Netflix conspiracy theory, yes, I think it's a little silly on the one hand. I think Netflix feels like they don't need theaters, and that's why they don't do theatrical runs and they don't commit to them, is that they don't need that. And as frustrating as that can be, I think, because there's something to be said, what Julia always made the point was, advertising a movie in theaters is the best way to advertise your movie on your streaming service. Because people are aware of it being in theaters, and then it comes to your streaming service and they're like, oh yeah, I didn't see that. And they go, and so your marketing for your theatrical release is also your streaming marketing, which
is great. Also, you're giving perceived value. You're saying, oh wow, I know it's HBO. The dirty little secret and not so secret about HBO for so many decades is, despite Sopranos, Sex and the City, and absolutely serious, have become incredibly important. Until the streaming age, movies are what matter the most. It's what more people watch. It's like, oh, every Saturday I get a new recent blockbuster, and it would be 6 to 9 months later, but it's like, that was your value. Even if you didn't always watch, like, oh yeah, I get my movies on HBO. I'll see it when it's on HBO. And Netflix still gets some of that, and they should find a way,
So
you could do it through an output deal.
So
you
know? I feel like that's one of those things that's a little bit silly, but at the same time, I also think that one of the problems that a lot of streamers have with these movies is, you mentioned The Day After, which is a very special case, but it was a TV movie. And I remember the era, and I know you do too, where TV movies were really a thing, and they were very low budget. They were better budgets than TV dramas, but way less than you would get, and way less prestige than a motion picture that's released in theaters. And then a decade later, there was more direct-to-video releases, which were also lower budget. And this is part of the issue here, is I think that these streamers have so much money that and they get so excited, and Apple absolutely falls in this category. They get so excited about working with stars and working with very talented people and maybe getting nominated for Oscars and things like that, that I think that they are not necessarily sort of staying within themselves with the idea of, like, you know, very, very expensive movies are probably not what we should be bankrolling. We should probably be bankrolling the modern equivalent of the movie of the week, which today, given production values and the amazing technology that we use to make TV shows and movies, will look great and look like not just $1 million, but tens of millions of bucks, but it's not going to cost you $300 million. Or in the case of Wolfs with Apple, $75 million just for the talent before any other money is spent, just for John Watts, Brad Pitt, and George Clooney. Maybe not, like, and I get the idea that it's kind of an advertising for your service and that it's the thing people want to see and they're going to come to your service to see it. But if I had to put my finger down on what the problem is with streamers and them buying movies, I would go back to saying, I think they're just getting caught up in the romance of stars and big talent and spending money they shouldn't spend.
Because
Netflix, and I think Netflix is learning this lesson, they still are going to do some tentpoles, but not as many. Like, better to have a new mid-budget movie in a few different genres that hit really well every week or two throughout the year than it is to have, you know, spend $300 million on something.
I could not agree more. I think they've wasted, I don't know if it's wasted, but they've invested a lot of money that I don't think they need to. And look, here's the thing. You take all these movies that are coming up on Apple and Netflix and Prime Video that star sort of like Gen X stars, right? Yeah. And some sort of dramas and stuff. Now imagine a world where all the streamers said, no, we're not going to finance those. You go out to the movie studios. Well, and then you look at where Disney and Universal and Sony are these days and what sort of movies they're making and then the return they're getting. Guess what? Most of those movies, I'll bet you, would not have gotten made.
Yes.
If you took the streamers out of the equation, that market would dry up.
Or
which is why
they would take a lower fee and have a smaller budget, and Ridley Scott would still get to make Napoleon, but he couldn't make it at the level that he made.
Well,
it
he couldn't
Apple.
Get anywhere near the level of what he could make. You know, and Napoleon maybe, but I'm talking just even some of the movies like Wolves or you know, some of the, all these comedies, whatever streaming is making. Right. And yet they're paying
those
these
Zack Snyder movies, those whatever, Rebel Moon movies, right? Like, come on,
right? And so they're paying, but you know, then I'm even talking just some more of the adult stuff, like even the spectacles. But yeah, sure. But even it was even some of those mid level. You know, I think some studios are still going to try to take chances on spectacles because they go, okay, they can optimistically think, okay, we can open this.
Yeah, maybe.
But they know they can't open, you know,
the mid-budgets. Yeah.
Right. And when they do, like something like Bottoms or whatever, some other stuff, like it plays in theaters, but it doesn't cost a lot, but they're paying sort of top dollar for some of those stars, you know, and you know,
those deals wouldn't be made.
And so the thing is, these actors are going to have to realize that the days of those salaries are over, but there needs to be a way of sort of doing those mid-budget things. And yes, I think there's both. Netflix does make sort of TV movies, and they do successful. Mm-hmm. Those Kissing Booth movies, all that. There's something in between that I think they can do more of. And also better to have sort of figure out a way to do an output deal to say, all right, we'll invest in your movies. We're going to allocate, you know, 400 whatever to be investors. You get it, and we get it within 2 months, right?
Yeah.
And so it's there, and we're the first window, you know. And I think that makes a lot more sense. And just sort of, you know, one thing I was pitching like 10 years ago, and I still think it would have made sense, and it makes even more sense now in the streaming era is. For some of those, you know, we used to love independent movies, right? Back in the 90s and 2000s. Mm-hmm. I used to go to a lot of them. You might have as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they'd play in the Angelica Theater or the Sunset Five in Los Angeles. And they would be made for $5 million, but they would be great movies and get all sorts of attention. And sometimes would star a lot of really interesting actors who would do relatively well-known because they want to do their passion projects. Well, you know, for the same thing, you could have, you know, again, for $5-7 million a week, you know, they could be making the best independent movies with the best directors and talent, and just, you know, that could be done. And I think that would be a better use of time because you would get people coming, and you've got a platform that people are going to tune in. And so, yeah, I do think the movie strategies need to change. I think, as usual, Netflix sort of goes in, they disrupt it, and then they adjust. They've done it with TV. They started in scripted series trying to be HBO, and now they might as well be Bravo or sci-fi or NBC or CBS
all those things now.
And I think that will be the case in movies, and I think it's to their thing. They should try to find a way to get theatrical windows because I think it's a way to monetize the investment, and I think it's sort of foolish not to, but they can be stubborn. Netflix, we'll see if other platforms like Apple and Prime I think is a little bit better at sort of realizing there are multiple models and ways to get there.
Yeah, Apple, I mean, what happened with Wolves, and I think that they got cold feet, is they felt like they agreed to a major theatrical release of this movie with Brad Pitt and George Clooney, and they realized this is not the kind of movie that's going to open big, and that the cost of doing the large theatrical rollout just wasn't there. And I know a lot of the stories are, oh, the talent, you know, talent's not happy with it, but the talent wouldn't have been. My guess is that this was a data-informed decision where Apple looked at it and said, the talent's not going to be happy either way because this thing's not going to play well. And we just are going to take it, you know, do our theatrical run for awards qualification purposes, and then we're going to put it on TV Plus, where our older audience of people who really love Brad Pitt and George Clooney are going to go see it. And that'll be great.
Whatever happened to platforming movies? I guess this is part of the movie business, which is always left out, but the theatrical chains consolidation, and you've got two or three big chains calling on the shots. But like, this was a type of movie, like, why not have this roll out over 6 to 8 weeks where it opens in a few cities and then a few more and a few more. And then it never even really goes wide. But when it does, it's sort of, it's there, and it slowly gets enough money over the course of seven weeks where it makes $20 million.
Because Apple wants it in 4 weeks, right? Apple wants it in 6 weeks. They're the rollout strategy there in the modern era. Another point I wanted to make while we're being a little iconoclastic here is I think that you could even question the idea of movies versus TV when they're on streaming. And this is, I think, an older generations. And I would also say, like, I think Apple knows how to make TV shows now. And I think Netflix obviously knows how to make TV shows now. And yet they struggle with movies. And one of the reasons, I think, is that they think of movies as something different. And I know that sometimes is about movie stars and movie directors. And they don't want to think, most of them don't want to think differently about this. Think different. There it is. And like, we live in a streaming era. Not everything needs to be a movie. You know, you mentioned The Day After as a TV movie. There are also, that was a great era of miniseries.
Sure.
The idea that you go to a director and actors and you say, this, you know, it's really great that you want to do this thing about Napoleon. Could we do this as a mini series? Could we build it? And I know that means it's TV or something, but like, would it work better in that format? I think that might be a better fit for streaming. And but you have to get over the hump of people are like, no, I only do movies. And so I wanted to mention somebody who is, I think, a little surprising late career decision making that I think is super smart. And that's Harrison Ford. Yeah, he did the Indiana Jones movie. Took that money, but he's in a Yellowstone spinoff and he's in Shrinking on Apple TV Plus. These are TV shows. He's a movie star in TV shows.
Well, so is Nicole Kidman too. I mean,
And I think that's the thing is that those people I think are smart and I'm sure he's getting paid a lot of money, but the bottom line is like being in a movie or a miniseries or a TV show, it doesn't matter.
Well, yes and no. I think there's a role for actual look. I think the problem with a lot of TV shows is that they've tried to become like movies. And that's actually heard a lot of TV shows. Seriously, there are 8-episode movies, right? And we see that all the time.
It's the other direction.
And that's not always good. I think, but I'm also okay with that. I'm okay. I think there is a new genre. Nobody was called at this and called after it. We do have, you know, there are a lot of TV critics who get upset. I think it's fine that we have sort of TV show movies. And sometimes they go for 2 seasons, but they really are sort of different. And it plays that way, and it's not as episodic. The problem is that too many platforms have gotten away from just making episodic TV shows because they're trying to be too big, and they're trying when they don't need to be. You know, something like the Kara Russell show, which is coming back on Halloween. The Diplomat. Exactly. I love. And it was great for what it was, but it's a TV show movie that plays out.
Yeah, I guess so. That felt a little more like a cable TV show to me.
Well, it did. It definitely had a West Wing vibe and all that. So it had some TV show elements and soapiness, but it also had a season long story arc when it could have easily just have been sort of standalone episodes and over 12 episodes a season as opposed to eight episodes. It could have been sort of like story of the week. And instead they went for big overarching story, which is what I mean by more of the cinematic experience.
No, you're right.
You know, lost it. And that's what we've lost.
Slow Horses, which just came back on Apple TV Plus, and I love that show, but that show is adapting novels. And so every season is a story. So it is a series of TV show movies, using your term,
And that's great. The UK does that. And we've had a lot of UK television. Look, the UK model has become more prominent in the streaming era. And that's absolutely great. I'm someone who wants to see everyone doing a whole bunch of things.
Like you said, we have lost, and this goes back to talking about mid-budget movies. It's the mid-budget TV show. Mm-hmm. And Netflix, I think this is one of those areas where Netflix is figuring it out more than other people are right now, which is sometimes what you really want is just a TV show with episodes that are discrete episodes, and you do not have it's not a little movie in 5 parts. It is something that's a little more comforting and simple, and you can watch them one at a time, and it's fine.
But even there, they've sort of stumbled the ball in my mind, and I've written about this, because they have not adapted. Those types of shows should be weekly releases. Those types of shows should produce 16 episodes a season. That 90 show or that 80 show, whatever it is now, I think it's that 90 show, that should just be in continuous production with a couple other Netflix comedies. And every week, there should be 3 episodes, one of each of those things. The same thing with drama.
I talked about the idea a while ago about the fact that one of the great things that network TV still does is generate those massive, you know, 15, 20 episodes a year that then do incredibly well on streaming, but no streaming network wants to commit to doing 20 episodes of a show in a year, which I would argue is kind of foolish. But if you can make a deal with a TV network to help create these shows, and then they have incredible value, because the when you hear about these incredibly successful binges, they're all coming from whether it's sitcoms or whether it's even something like Suits, they're all coming from big catalogs that would never exist if they were streaming originals.
And there are people, though, the fact is there are still millions of people every week who watch network shows. So this is why, like, Peacock sort of does some of this, and Hulu, you know, they do sort of find windows in a way, right? And there are people who only watch Abbott Elementary when it finally comes, the full season's done on Disney Plus or whatever, or Paramount Plus or whatever. But the networks, you know, they're unfortunately disinvesting in their networks as opposed to finding a way to sort of, you know, eliminate the walls between them and just sort of make more content that lives where it lives. And you know, but that's a whole other story for another day.
Yeah, one of the things that it was refreshing, and it's because it's a co-pro, but one of the things I liked about Disney Plus buying Doctor Who is that Doctor Who is much more aggressively a weekly adventure. Mm-hmm. It's an anthology series with ongoing characters and has been for 60 years, right? But it is a stark difference from a Star Wars show that is a TV show movie. And it was a reminder of like, oh yeah, it's just, where are we going this week? That's a TV feeling that isn't there as often as it should be.
And it's a way, the reason why they should be doing this is because it's a way to get people to open up their apps daily, weekly, to find destinations. That's why I continue to think that, you know, it's ridiculous that more no streamers have gone. Amazon has experimented through Freevee with a daytime soap, but it's a UK soap. But they should be reinventing soap operas and weekly series. And I think that would make all the sense in the world.
But we'll see. This episode's gotten so we had the political segment. Now we got the existential segment about content in the streaming era. This is great. I'm sure talk about this more down the road. I did want to talk before we go. I've got a couple other topics here, and people who want me to talk about sports. Joe's not that excited about sports. I'm going to get a sports guest probably next time, and we're going to talk about what's going on with Diamond and with Venue. There's a lot going on there too. But Joe, for something completely different, everybody, you wrote a story about the launch, and I'm not making this up, of Hallmark Plus. That's right. Hallmark has, I mean, they already sort of did, but now they really have a streaming service. Tell me about Hallmark Plus.
You sound sort of, are you just not a Hallmark person?
It's funny because I went to college with somebody who writes Hallmark movies. She's got a Hallmark movie or two every year, and it's hilarious when she's promoting it. It's not my thing. But I understand what a cultural phenomenon it is. And I think and something that's happened over doing this podcast is this idea that we sometimes get so focused on these big streamer plays and we miss little niches that are really interesting. And I do believe that in the end, you know, there's going to be consolidation on the big streamer side, but that there are lots of really nice ecological niches for places to live. What's interesting here is that you've got Hallmark, which already has a linear channel and a deal with Peacock, saying we're also going to take our Hallmark Movies Now service and rebranded as Hallmark Plus and say that is also part of our business strategy. Along with like going into Hallmark stores, I think it's really interesting.
Well, it really is. And look, I had never watched a Hallmark movie in my life until that Peacock deal happened. And I'd seen some of the Christmas movies talked about and buzzed, but I said, oh, they look cheesy. Maybe I don't know if I would have liked them. And I certainly wasn't enjoying trying to go to the Hallmark ecosystem where there's a commercial every 8 minutes and on-screen bugs that never stop. And it's just it's just not for me. They suddenly are there on Peacock a few years ago, the height of the pandemic. Things are dark. It's like, I just want some little light. Let me try them. And they're easily available on Peacock and no commercials because I've got ad-free Peacock. And I was like, you know what? These movies actually aren't half bad. They're sort of like, they're very optimistic and they're a little cheesy. Okay, a lot cheesy. But the acting is pretty decent, actually, and looks pretty good. And you know what? During the holidays, it's sort of fun. And I've sort of become a Hallmark guy, and I don't know how that happened. But they're cheesy, but they're fun, and they're easy to watch. But more to the point, Hallmark has been sort of, up until now, a conscientious objector in the streaming wars. They sort of, and not completely, because they had little toes in there. Like I said, they had a streaming service since 2017 called Hallmark Movies Now, but it was almost like 95%, 98% library stuff. So old stuff that had run on Hallmark, just a chance for people who had cut the cord to sort of get a taste of that old school Hallmark that they might have missed. And then they did a few years ago, they experimented with Peacock. Peacock basically sort of did a cable carriage deal with them, where Peacock actually carries the live feed of Hallmark and has video on demand rights for 3 days to begin with. It's changed a little bit recently. They basically, Peacock pays for every subscriber it has, it pays a fee to Hallmark the way that Spectrum or Cox Cable or Comcast, whatever, pays to Hallmark. So it's just another cable deal, but it gets it to a different audience. So that's great. Now they finally decided, you know what? Even though our ratings are still doing good on linear, there are so many people who are younger who are cutting the cord, or maybe they never got a cord, and they sort of like the Hallmark brand, and they're into this sort of vibe. we got to serve them somehow. So they're launching on September 10th, Hallmark Plus. They're rebooting Hallmark movies now. And for $2 more, they're going to continue to do what they've been doing, which is sort of older libraries of Hallmark movies. But they're going to be doing some original scripted series that mm-hmm. fit into the Hallmark vibe. They're going to do about 3 movies every month that are exclusive and will premiere on Hallmark Movies Now, on Hallmark Plus.
See? Movies.
Movies, actual movies, just mm-hmm. and they're made for $5 yep. in Canada or Malta or whoever has the best tax incentive that week. Mm-hmm. But you know what? They're made with writers who are really ambitious and want to prove themselves, starring actors who are trying to break through. And you know what? A lot of them are really good, and they may not get. But I would put them against half the ones in, you know, in some Netflix original movies. So anyway, and you're going to get sort of all of that. That then they've got a great. Tie into their Hallmark stores where you get some free cards every month and some free gifts so that Amazing. Audience of people who come in for Hallmark, they can sell them and sort of, hey, this is also a rewards program. So we expanded and it's just, it's a great niche. And unfortunately, they're a public company or a private company rather. So I don't know how many people are subscribing. They say it's pretty decently. And I think that's probably right. I think Hallmark has been a big boon to Peacock. Peacock people seem very excited yeah, about the numbers.
For sure.
So it fills an audience niche very well. And it sort of lets them sort of continue to experiment with how do we keep our cable business just as strong? They're not cutting back on their content. They're not like FX. Suddenly, all the good shows from FX are not going to be Hulu exclusives with just a few shows that are still on FX. Or the shows that are on FX, then are next day on Hulu. The movies that run and this Christmas on Hallmark Channel are not going to premiere next day on
Hallmark Plus.
So, you know, they sort of are sort of the best of both worlds. Their linear ecosystem remains strong. They're not cutting budgets for linear. They are continuing to do just as many Christmas movies as they have before. If you watch a movie, if you want to watch a new Hallmark Christmas movie, you can't watch it next day on Hallmark Plus. They're separate things. Hallmark Plus is going to be additive, and it's going to test the theory that we can sort of create another added bonus for people who are really into this ecosystem right. or simply aren't going to pay for a cable bundle or aren't interested in Peacock for $10 a month.
About spending money, and I think one of the things that I really like about this idea too is that I think, you know, the stuff that's coming on linear now, you'll see it there eventually, maybe like in a year. And the stuff that they're going to build for the streamer will probably go back to linear, right? Not all of it, but some of it, but not for a year at least. So they're kind of long-term double dipping maybe, but not short-term.
Well, yes, and I just to correct you a little bit, I don't think, I think a lot of stuff is going to go from Plus to not all of it, you're right, but a lot, certainly some of their movies are going to in different ways, and I think it could be more like 6 to 9 months on okay. some of them, and they've already shrunk some of the windows. Some stuff that was on Hallmark Channel this June is now on Hallmark Movies Now / Hallmark Plus, so I think they are narrowing it, but you know, it's hard for cable operators to complain about that when every other major media company that has scripted cable networks is basically cut to the bones. There's almost no content on it, right? There's very little. It's sports and some events. Or if there is scripted content still, it airs next day on streaming. Hallmark at least is keeping a pretty strong window between them. It's much shorter than it used to be, but still you're right. It's a different thing. And I think that keeps the cable operators happy, but it allows them to sort of expand the base. Yeah. They've also done some experimentation with windows too. The VOD window for the first 2 years of the Peacock deal was Peacock Hallmark movies ran on Peacock for 3 days. For the last few months, they've been 30 days,
yeah.
as well as on video on demand. And that makes a lot of sense because Peacock execs were saying, well, we like these. They're performing well, but not enough people can get to them because it's especially during the week. They don't have time. So by sort of compromising, that helps cable operators because they can tell their customers, hey, you can see even more on our on-demand content. It helps the Peacock people, and it's sort of a nice, happy medium. And this is the sort of compromise and sort of smart sort of like thinking that I wish that big streamers would be more into and less dogmatic. Netflix in particular, right? Netflix is right to say that most people want to watch a lot of shows all at once binging, but people have different kinds of needs. And there are some people who actually do like watching a show week to week. If it's a show that doesn't have, you know, continuing storylines or confusing storylines, and it's just sort of a case of the week, why not air it every week? But Netflix stays very dogmatic. Hallmark is open to, hey, whatever works, let's try it all.
Yeah, I like it. This is a good segue into our final topic. because I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff going on at areas where the stakes are a little lower, the budgets are a little lower, and they're not necessarily being scrutinized and considered the future of TV in some ways. And this is what I also heard people talking about Fast. And New York Times did a big piece about Tubi that's funny because it's sort of like, we just discovered Tubi. It's like, okay.
Yeah, I've been writing about Tubi for a couple of years, but
right,
yes.
Right, but all of these Fast channels, and Tubi is doing really well, and Fox owns Tubi. So when I say Fox doesn't have a streaming strategy, they don't have necessarily a big streaming strategy for like their sports and their broadcast network, but they do for their news channel, and they do for Fast with Tubi. And I think what's really interesting is we have now reached a point where a lot of streaming services have caught up with Tubi in the sense that there are ads on a lot of streaming services now. And Tubi is a Fast and ad-supported streamer that's free. And as they pointed out, no login required. You can literally just launch it and watch TV and leave it on. And then, yeah, there are ads. Like, it feels less different now that there are streaming channels on other streaming services that are just on all the time, like Peacock has a bunch of those that you just turn it on and it streams, and that there are ads on all these services. It feels like Tubi is less weird than it used to be. And there are others. There's Pluto TV, which I think is Paramount owns.
It was before Pluto, yes.
Yeah, Pluto and Roku and Tubi, all these weird names, but that's fine. Anyway, I like that the New York Times discovered it. That's great. But I also like the fact that people are noticing this undetected and kind of looked down upon aspect of television that honestly feels more like television
sure.
than streaming services do.
Yeah, Fast is something I've been fascinated with, as it were, for a couple of years. And it started with Pluto, which really sort of pioneered the sort of lean back sort of experience of Fast that we think of, where it's just like turning on a cable system and flipping through 100 channels. Tubi, it has mostly taken a different path. They're sort of Netflix, but without the fees. They are sort of a on-demand forward model that has since caught up and decided to ask the channels experience where you flip through channels. Amazon has Freevee, and now, of course, has its own suite of channels and advertising on the main system. So there are two different things, and there's AVOD versus Fast. It gets sort of complicated and weird and whatever. But the common thread, of course, is free and broad. And you know, I love the Fast space. I think the Fast space itself needs to be disrupted in a way too. Mm. You know, the idea of, hey, we've got 200 or 500 or 800 linear channels, flip through it. Well, you've also got a lot of bloat now, and discovering content when you've got that much, it's there, but it hasn't completely solved the problem of curation when you're still confronted with so many choices and you can't even find some of that when the virtual channels are just one show that sort of plays endlessly. You know, Peacock, by the way, is fake Fast. I have a real bone to pick with them, because they just have like episodes. As soon as you press it, the episode starts at the beginning.
It's just
so
a playlist.
They don't even, it's just a playlist, which is fine.
Playlists on streaming services
100%. Well, the fact, you know, Hulu, it's funny, they have some sort of vestigial limbs from the old days of Hulu. You know, you'll go into like the Golden Girls on Hulu, and you'll see if you click somewhere, they will actually have a few playlists of like essential types of episodes or theme episodes, right? And they're like 5 or 6 of them haven't been updated in like 5 years,
right?
But they're like, oh, I just want the episodes where they go on a vacation or whatever. Well, why isn't that being done with all sorts of libraries? Why aren't there,
right?
You know, they do it sometimes during holiday seasons, which is good, but there's not enough of that. And you know, with Fast, the problem with Fast, which started off strong, Pluto suffered because it basically became a tool of Paramount, and everything was funneled into Paramount Plus, and Pluto got neglected, and the content got less, and it got all about promoting stuff that's on Paramount as opposed to just being broad. Fox has been smarter. They, for one hot minute, the same executives who ran Fox also ran Tubi, and then they've always said, oh, no, these are separate businesses. And so while Fox content does run on Tubi, there's a window like a week later, your Fox primetime shows, a lot of them will run on Tubi. They're operated separately because they're different audiences. What we need in FAST now, Jason, and I'm a real proponent for this, I may write about it at some point, is we need curated channels that feel like networks, you know, as opposed to having it's fine to have 500 channels and something on, but why not have 10 Tubi channels or 10 Pluto channels that are curated, that have schedules, that are expected, that are, dare I say it, cable. Mm. Cable without the monthly bill and the login, but cable nonetheless, you know that, oh yeah, I'm watching, you know, Tubi 3, or I'm watching on Pluto, I'm watching TV Land on Pluto, which they technically have, but like don't really program it like TV Land. But what if you knew that there was a little bit of marketing, or just not even marketing because that costs money, but just some interstitials, a regular schedule, and you knew, oh yeah, Monday nights on Tubi is on Pluto is Friends, and Tuesday night is Gilligan's Island, and Wednesday night, or you know, there are different ways. Everyone is sort of still aping the Netflix model of binge, binge, binge. How about curate? How about schedule? How about create flow and variety? Because people like variety. They don't always want to just watch the same thing. It's and you don't have to choose. You can have both for people who do like the idea of tuning in and seeing, you know, Garage Wars, or is that a show? Garage Wars, Storage Wars? I don't know my reality
Garage
shows.
Wars should be a show.
It should be. You know, Jay Leno, of course, has to host. You know, that's my soapbox. I actually just stood up while I said all that
because I needed
to get on my soapbox. But don't you think that there's a role for curation and just having virtual networks?
The greatest frustration I have, and I've said this on this podcast over the years, is I feel like there is very little innovation when it comes to features inside apps that everybody is focused. And I think this is a fundamental problem with the TV industry is they think their job is to make programs. And the problem is that they are in a user-facing business now. They are the interface. Mm-hmm. They control the software. And that curation and better functionality, other than like Netflix that's innovated with having you, and YouTube, having you just keep hitting the feeder bar and getting another pellet. But like there's more to life than just pure algorithmic churn. And that's where you get a little bit of curation. You get a little bit of... I'll throw in extra features as well. If you're a super fan, what about we let you watch it with a commentary? What about we roll you right into the ancillary material that currently only gets the idea that networks have shows where all their ancillary material is on YouTube and not in their streamer? It's just, what are you doing? And yes, curated playlists, curated nights of TV. I back on the TV Talk Machine podcast, I always talk to Tim about the slow binge. We program the slow binge, which is, you know, we're watching, maybe there's an episode a night or episode every other night, but rather than my wife and I watching like four episodes of a show in a night, we'll watch a sitcom and then maybe a YouTube show or a reality show, and then maybe cap it off with a drama. We're programming our own nights of TV. You know what would be great is if we didn't have to do that because the software did it for us.
Jason, are you stealing the slow binge from me, or have we just like really twins? Because I've been talking about the slow binge for years, and I do sort of the same thing. It's just it's a natural thing, and I agree.
We're just
like
slow binge
buddies.
Why isn't there a play exactly?
Why aren't there play? I've been saying this for 5-10 years. Why are there not playlists of like 8 different sitcoms, and I watch, you know, at a time? It would make all the sense in the world. It's easy to do, but you're right. They're just addicted to the same old. And you know, I've done stories with Netflix with their engineering team, and you know, they remember a few years ago they had this thing called Play Something on Netflix. They experimented with it, and it was meant to be sort of a shuffle button, right? And they did a lot of work on it. I did a whole story. I talked to the creators about it. It really didn't go anywhere. I guess it didn't work. They took it away 2 years later. But the thing is, they pay a lot of money and have a lot of really smart engineers, but I've seen so much less innovation from Netflix's tech side in the last 4 years. It's like, what happened? They suddenly became an old sclerotic network where they're not innovating. At least with the legacy companies like Max and Disney, I understand why. They can barely stay afloat getting people to just get into, they needed to get content, spend everything, and engineering is expensive, and they didn't have the, you know, just getting it to work is enough of a challenge, right? Getting, make sure it doesn't crash. But what is Netflix and Amazon and even Apple to some degree? Yeah. What is their, Apple doesn't have enough content, but those others, like, where is that innovation? And it just, that speaks to the tech mentality, right? If it's not 100% efficient, they don't seem to understand that. And boy, are they losing out.
Yeah. So you've got the entertainment people who just think about making content. And then you've got the tech people who I think are focused on algorithmic kind of like churn and not seeing the value in having, and this is why, because we started talking about Tubi, this is why it's only now that people are rediscovering things like, oh yeah, a lot of times you're just folding laundry. A lot of times you just, you're going to make dinner, but you want something on and you don't want to, in fact, you really don't want to focus on a show that you have to focus on. You want something that's familiar or that doesn't matter. And it's so easy to be able to just say, let's just play this thing and pleasant things will happen that I don't have to pay attention to. And I think that there's a lack, that is the place where this industry has sort of lacked. I think you see the uptick in Tubi. One of the reasons is that it's so simple to do that. And I agree with you. It's almost malpractice that if you've got a big catalog that you haven't found some interesting ways to slice that catalog to make appointment viewing, to make people come back every day. I know this, honestly, it's not innovative, I would say, but things like Cozy TV that are riding on secondary broadcast channels on the digital band and are showing old episodes of TV shows from the 70s and 80s and 90s, they're more like that than I think. And I think that they program
Buzzer
a weekly
on the Game Show Network.
Yeah, right. Exactly. They're programming. And the idea there is that every night at 8, there's a Magnum PI or whatever. And every night at 9, there's a Rockford Files or whatever it is.
And this is, and it particularly galls me that Peacock and Paramount Plus haven't done this, or Hulu, which is owned by
ABC.
They've got the catalog.
I know.
And by the way, you know, the other reason it's malpractice, and it's also malpractice even for Netflix, which doesn't have the catalog it once did, but it still has a deep one, is by not creating that sort of space, by not carving out their own sort of channels and experiences, they're inviting people to go to an inferior product, which is Tubi or Pluto. Because look, I like those. Tubi actually so far is good. They do not overload you with commercials. Pluto, I refuse to even watch most of the time because it's literally the same, if not larger than cable commercial load, which is like, no, I'm paying, you know, $60, $70. You know, like, and look, that's part of the dual revenue stream model. Cable sort of became the reason people were so quick to jump, cut the cord, is because cable just, there's a word for it, made itself worse, and crapification, let's call it. That because you ended up paying so much more and you got so many more commercials and so much less content. But you know what? If you're paying already for this content, it wouldn't cost you that much more to give people 15 Netflix channels. And if you had ad-free Netflix, you would see no ads.
Right.
And if you had it with ads, you'd probably see a little bit more than if you watched on demand, but you'd still get there. And imagine the perception of value.
Right.
If you knew, oh, wow, Netflix now comes with 20 channels. Oh, I can turn on Netflix One and I can see this. And by the way, when new shows premiere, the first episode's going to premiere Monday. The first episode of Squid Game is going to be on Netflix One Thursday at 9 o'clock. And then Friday or right after, it's going to be all available just on Netflix. Well, you could create that communal experience. You still see HBO brilliantly still leans into this with its HBO Sunday night at 9 o'clock. 90% of people don't watch it on the HBO linear channel, but they go to Max 9 o'clock on Sundays because they pretend they're still watching HBO.
Yes.
People still have that. And not everyone is 23 years old. Not everyone grew up on YouTube. As long as we're still alive, create that. And by the way, train the new viewers, the younger viewers, to get into that, because guess what? That's a better way to hold their attention.
Yep. All true. This is great. We will continue.
We worked out some issues.
We exercised
some demons.
Yeah, we did, and extolled the virtue of the slow binge, which is great. We're doing the slow binge high five right now. Thank you to listener James, by the way, for sending in the New York Times piece about Tubi that kicked this all off. It was good to see that the New York Times has discovered fast now. If you have a question for us or want to send us a link, downstreamfeedback.com is where you go. We love to hear from you. Love to hear mothers. As always, that's a classic from Tim Goodman era that I still keep kicking around. We have reached the end of this episode. If you haven't yet, please consider subscribing to Downstream Plus. This is a full-sized episode for everyone. The only way to hear the complete version of our next episode and our previous episode is to subscribe. Go to downstream.plus to subscribe and support the show. You can find me at sixcolors.com. I appear at many other podcasts at Relay and at theincomparable.com. And Joe, where can people find your stuff?
Of course, vulture.com. You can subscribe to my buffering newsletter. Yeah. Just Google Joe Adalian Buffering. It's free. And you can read me on the Twitter and the Blue Sky at TVMOJOE, as in Mojo.
TV Mojo. Excellent. And we will be back in 2 weeks with more Downstream. But until then, thanks everybody out there for listening. We'll see you next time.